in the storefronts and shop windows of Jonesboro, Arkansas. There are signs that read, "Our hearts are with Westside Middle School."
It's All Things Considered. I'm Daniel Zwerdling. President Clinton sent that radio message today from thousands of miles away in Africa to mourn the students and teacher gunned down earlier this week in the president's home state. And in a moment, we'll hear more from President Clinton's remarks on the Jonesboro shootings, which made one of the more poignant speeches of his administration. But first, we go to NPR's Cheryl Corley in Jonesboro, who watched today as the community buried three of its five victims.
There were no bells ringing at any of the three services today. It was as if these funerals were too somber for even that. Instead, as mourners filed into Emerson Chapel for the separate funerals of 12-year-old Stephanie Johnson and 11-year-old Brittany Varner, they hugged and held hands. A group of girls, no more than 13, were dressed casually in shirts and pants as if they were ready to go to the mall and have fun with their friends on a Saturday. One stood out. She was dressed in heels and a black skirt and jacket. The girls huddled close. About 300 people attended Stephanie's funeral, a dark-haired girl whom friends called friendly and quiet. Mourners wept softly as pop songs were played, "Let Her Cry" by Hootie and the Blowfish, Elton John's "Candle in the Wind," and rap star Puff Daddy's tribute to a fallen friend, "I'll Be Missing You." One mourner, Chuckling Dewey Graves, the chaplain at a local church, said the pastor at Stephanie's funeral talked about how the family and Jonesboro area residents will get through their grief with the help of God and how significant the support from others had been.
I think it means great comfort to know we have so many people here in our community reaching out in love.
Thirty-two-year-old Shannon Wright was a favorite teacher for many students at Westside Middle School. Her funeral was broadcast over local radio station KBTM. Her husband, Mitch, and two-year-old son, Zane, and several hundred people passed into the small yellow brick Bono Church of God a few miles outside of Jonesboro. Outside of the church, two 10th grade students, Jamie and Jenny, recalled their days with Shannon Wright in the 6th grade. They called Wright their favorite teacher and a friend.
She gave us nicknames. I was Smart, she was James, and she was Goofy, and Miss Wright was Snoopy.
Sounds like a fun class.
Oh, it was. It was
always smiles. She was really sweet. She was always happy.
We had the wheel, and we were good, so I spin the wheel, and she gave us
candy.
Cordless phones and stuff.
During the funeral, Pastor Benny Baker spoke and told Shannon Wright's family and other mourners that today the world watches them as they try to respond to something they never thought they'd have to respond to. Baker said the events of the last few days have been like having a jigsaw puzzle of a person's life turned over.
Our purpose is to find all the pieces and to find those parts of our lives that are the most important for us to hold on to.
The service for Shannon Wright was not without its moments of humor. There were stories about her hair and how her husband said her devotion to it often made them late. Baker told the group that if the community failed to continue on, it would be an even greater tragedy. And he had a word for teachers who had come to say a last goodbye to a comrade. He told them to go to school Monday and do their job.
Yes, there's going to be pain. And there's going to be struggle. But you will honor the memory of Shannon Wright. If you enter that classroom on Monday morning with a reaffirmed passion to teach and to be the teacher you have been called to be.
Today ends the funerals. Next Tuesday, Jonesboro will hold a citywide memorial honoring the memory of all five victims who were slain in the schoolyard of Westside Middle School. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Jonesboro.
As we mentioned just before Cheryl's report, President Clinton devoted his weekly radio address today to the Jonesboro killings. And for the record, here's an excerpt of what he said.
We must teach our children to respect others. We must instill in them a deep, abiding sense of right and wrong. And the children who are troubled, angry, or alone, we must extend a hand before they destroy the lives of others and destroy their own in the process. We have to understand that young children may not fully appreciate the consequences of actions that are destructive, but may be able to be romanticized at a twisted moment. And we have to make sure that they don't fall into that trap. Three towns, Jonesboro, Pearl, Paducah. Too many precious lives lost. The white ribbons that flutter today in my home state of Arkansas are a poignant and powerful challenge to all of us, a challenge to come together for the sake of our children and for the future of our nation.
President Clinton speaking in his weekly radio address earlier today. The recent killings in schoolyards and hallways seem to confirm what a lot of Americans already think, that it's dangerous to send their kids to school, which has prompted administrators at one school in New Mexico to try to make their grounds the safest in the nation, partly by using the latest high-tech equipment. It's part of a pilot project supervised by Sandia National Laboratories, which is better known for designing security systems to protect the Pentagon's nuclear bombs. Ron Marquez, principal of the Belen High School in Belen, New Mexico, has watched Sandia work magic at his school. Am I exaggerating your view, Ron Marquez?
No, you're not. Actually, it would be magic in regards to some of the statistics and some of the information that we can share with people with regards to not only security, but just safety all around.
Before we get to those statistics, tell us what were the problems plaguing your school in particular?
Well, a couple of things that stand out, and I think that these are problems in several schools, not just in Belen, New Mexico, was the amount of theft in regards to equipment. The other things that stand out would be vandalism due to student vehicles.
And what about fights? Any fights in the hallways?
We had some fights, but again, we have about 1,300 students with about 100 adults on campus at any given time, and we were averaging maybe a fight a week.
So if we drove up to your school tomorrow for a visit, what would we see? Take us step by step through your campus.
If you drove up to our campus, the first thing you'd see is a big set of yellow gates right at the perimeter of the property. And at that yellow gate, you're actually going to be stopped by one of our security aides. You're going to be asked to state your business. You'll actually have to sign in. That person has been trained to basically make sure that they take down your name, some information, some identification, also to basically describe your vehicle and maybe even take a license plate number of your vehicle, the time you actually checked in, and then even the time that you actually check out.
Okay, then I walk through the doors.
The first thing that you'll notice or that we'll notice is that you're going to be on camera as soon as you walk into our building. We have four cameras within the main office structure or the main administrative structure of the high school, and those cameras are set in certain areas where we can monitor or even watch what most people are doing.
And I have heard that Sandia has given you some rather unusual means to test if students are using drugs.
Sandia Labs provided us with approximately 75 hair analysis kits.
Hair analysis? Wow.
Yes, sir. You take a strand of hair, and you can send this particular piece of hair to a lab, and it will analyze to you whether that person has been on some form of drugs or anything like that.
So are teachers going around picking students' hairs off their desk?
No, sir. No, that's not our intent. Our intent actually was to, quite frankly, not even use these in a punitive measure, but if we had families or parents that were concerned about their son or daughter with the possibility of doing drugs, that we would hand these kits out to those people and they could basically have the analysis done totally confidential and totally private to them and to them only.
How has the community responded to all these measures? You know, students, parents, other people in the area? I'm assuming that at least some people have felt a little uncomfortable at what they consider to be, well, bordering on invasion of privacy.
I think that at least when we first started to talk about it, yeah, there was some paranoia. There was some fear about making our school look like a prison or something of that nature. But quite frankly, my understanding is that even as the community grew and understood what we were doing, they've really supported the issue because they truly want their kids safe at school.
And now let's get to those statistics that you call magic. How have things changed?
Well, the number one issue that sticks out is my first year as principal there without the project, we experienced about $50,000 worth of theft in regards to equipment. I'm talking about computers, TVs, VCRs, vandalism to the site, those types of things. The very next year with the project in place, we probably only made about $5,000 worth of claims as far as losses were concerned. So that's a major area as far as I'm concerned.
How about fights? Those one fight a week statistics you told me?
We used to have, I'd say that, but with the cameras in place and with security personnel simply roaming the campus, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, we've cut that down to where it's maybe even one a month or maybe even one every couple of months and things of that nature.
Do you think, even with these statistics, which are quite impressive, even if they are attributable to the security systems, do you find it a little sad at all that a school has to go to all these efforts?
Yeah, we definitely do. But you have to remember, you know, and I know that you talked about schools being dangerous, but society itself has become pretty much dangerous. You know, anytime we travel, anytime we simply even leave our homes, and even sometimes in our own home, we're not very, very comfortable or we're not very, very secure. So I think that, you know, we need to basically look at these things from a proactive standpoint and make sure that we can feel or allow people to feel comfortable.
I appreciate your joining us today.
You bet.
Ron Marquez is principal of the Belen High School in Belen, New Mexico. Of all the countries President Clinton has visited in Africa this past week, none has changed as fast and as dramatically as South Africa. And earlier today, the president planted a tree at a school in Soweto to honor the thousands of black students who rebelled against the apartheid system of education back in the 1970s. Scores of those children were killed in confrontations with white police. Today, under the government of Nelson Mandela, you wouldn't recognize most schools in South Africa. White and black children sit in the same classrooms, side by side, and white students are taught for the first time by black teachers. But there are still pockets of the country where the old white school establishment refuses to share power. And last month, a miniature race war broke out around Vryburg High School in cattle country, a couple hundred miles from Johannesburg. At one point, white parents stormed the school and attacked black children with whips. Timba Simba has been covering the crisis for the SABC, the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us, please, how the racial tensions at the school turned violent.
Because of the militant culture of black pupils who come from the townships who have had to fight for their rights for, you know, ever since they were born, they stood up and challenged the school principal. Then the next thing that happens is that the white parents find out about this, and then they storm the school, and then they beat up black pupils.
And they were actually carrying whips, as I mentioned? That's what we've been
hearing. They were carrying what you would call whips, but it's actually shamboks.
What is a shambok?
It's a kind of like a rubber kind of a whip.
And were many students seriously injured?
Yes, at least about 8 of them that I can remember that were seriously injured. Because I saw some, you know, a little girl that had a wound in his forehead. I don't know what had hit her, but she was bleeding, you know, and her shirt was filled with blood, and the others were actually limping. That was the kind of situation that happened.
And then I take it the fighting broke out between the students themselves. And at one point, even there was fighting between white and black police. Is that right?
Yes. Now, what the police did there, white police officers, is that they decided that the black police officers had to go on relief or something, basically to leave the scene. And they left the scene. And the white police then assaulted and arrested the black pupils. And when they took them to the charge office, then the black officers realized what had happened, and they decided that you know, they had been deceived, and they wanted to take over the case and lay charges on the students. That's when the fighting ensued.
Let's take a step back for a moment, please. I take it that under the country's new laws, schools are obligated to teach students in the major language that students prefer, right? And most whites at Vryburg High are being taught in Afrikaans, the language of apartheid in the old days, and most blacks are being taught in English, which I take it has virtually created two different schools under the same roof.
A separate school for the black pupils to be taught in English, but it doesn't have the same kind of facilities as the African section of the school.
And what kind of facilities don't the black students
have? The facilities
have
that I'm talking about are like computer facilities, the science lab, and, you know, textbooks and the likes.
If we could visit all the schools in South Africa, how many would be suffering racial tensions and even racial violence like Vryburg High?
Tensions are there, but in larger towns and cities, there is some kind of understanding that there's a new government and there are new laws that people have to abide too.
So, in fact, if we took this tour of schools, we would find that except for a few areas like Vryburg, that we would find white and black students going to school peacefully together in most of the country.
The same as it was, I'm sure, United States had emancipation of slaves and the civil rights and all that. And you had those little towns like Little Rock, Arkansas, and Rosewood and whatever. And you had those kind of tensions flowing through, but you didn't necessarily have them in the larger cities. I think there's a parallel there.
Timba Simba covers education for the SABC, the South Africa Broadcasting Corporation. He's been speaking to us from Johannesburg. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Police in Glendale, California, are investigating a hospital worker's claim that he has killed as many as 50 terminally ill patients since 1989. Hospital officials have fired the employee and suspended the staff of the department where he works while the investigation is underway, but no charges have been filed yet. From Los Angeles, Mandalit Del Barco has more.
State and local officials say earlier this month the worker confessed to killing as many as 50 patients at the Glendale Adventist Medical Center north of Los Angeles. The worker, who has been identified as Efren Saldivar, reportedly told authorities he was acting out of mercy and considers himself an angel of death. He allegedly used lethal injections of painkillers and muscle relaxers for cut off oxygen to patients who were unconscious. Glendale Police Sergeant Rick Young said today that officers held Saldivar in custody for questioning for 2 days and then released him because they had insufficient evidence that a crime had been committed. Young says a confession alone is not enough to file charges against him.
Why this is going to be a lengthy investigation, as you can imagine, here you have individuals that have died over a period of time, and we have to now prove if, in fact, they died at the hands of another. And it's a very difficult process for us to accomplish this because most of these patients were elderly and near death anyway.
Young says the investigation could take at least 6 months. He's upset that someone at the State Respiratory Care Board made the officer's statements public.
It's definitely going to put a roadblock on this investigation. You now have every news agency in the world following up on this story and tampering with potential witnesses and evidence. We're losing valuable evidence as we speak.
Although Young refused to comment on any detail of the investigation, there are reports that patients' files will be examined and that their bodies may now be exhumed. Hospital officials say their initial investigation showed no evidence of suspicious deaths since 1989 when Saldivar began to work there. His license was revoked yesterday, and all 43 other respiratory therapists at the medical center were suspended with pay while the investigation is underway. Saldivar's brother Eddie told reporters that the allegations could not be true. "There's no proof, no evidence," he was quoted saying. "Show me the proof. Why isn't he arrested?" Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The system of crime and punishment in the nation's courts is suffering, according to Clinton administration officials, because there are so many vacancies on the federal bench. Across the country, one of every 8 judges' slots remains unfilled. And last week, one of the administration's latest nominees said no thanks, and she dropped out of the running, rather than face hostile senators who vowed to block her nomination. Her name is Frederica Masiah Jackson. She's a judge in Philadelphia. And her opponents, including some prosecutors there, charge that she's anti-police and soft on criminals. But as NPR's Eric Westerveld reports from member station WHYY, a close look at some of her cases reveals a more complicated picture.
Fights over nominations to the lower federal courts are usually done behind closed doors, out of public view. During the Clinton administration, that's meant opponents use delay and stall tactics. Not in the case of Frederica Masiah Jackson. Her confirmation seemed on a fast track. With a vote of confidence from the Senate Judiciary Committee in November, she was well on her way to becoming the first black woman to sit on the federal bench in Philadelphia. But the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association picked out around 50 cases that they said showed she coddles criminals. Tom Gipping directs the Judicial Selection Monitoring Project, a conservative think tank. He says in the Masiah Jackson case, the system worked. It weeded out what he calls a judge with an extremist record
that favors criminals and is biased against prosecutors and cops, and a judge who does not know how to comport herself well in the courtroom. Everybody has to be judged, I think, on their own merits and their own record, and Judge Masiah Jackson's record was just simply not acceptable for a variety of very sound reasons based squarely on that record.
But how that record was used and interpreted bears some scrutiny. In her 18-plus years as a Common Pleas judge, Messiah Jackson heard more than 4,000 cases. A careful look at cases used to derail her nomination shows how easy it was to take information out of context and use it selectively, in essence, to manufacture a pattern of leniency. Take Commonwealth versus Moore. A group of rowdy teenagers gathered outside a home after midnight when a man yells at them to quiet down and move along. They don't. Then, according to court documents, kids see a hand with a gun stick out a window. Shots are fired, and one of the kids is injured. Judge Messiah Jackson rejects the prosecution's request for a stiff sentence and the defense move for acquittal. She gave the man a year probation.
This might just as easily have been a not guilty case because it's not quite clear who actually did the shooting. It might not have been the defendant. It might have been the son in this case.
Abraham Gaffney, a law professor at Villanova University, says the judge's verdict in this case was almost too harsh. Prosecutors in their report to the Senate point to the case as an example of leniency. But a careful look at the transcript shows prosecutors failed to point out several key pieces of information. The weapon was, in fact, a pellet gun. Hospital records show the injury was not serious and that the man who allegedly fired the shot was elderly and had no prior criminal record. Professor Gaffney.
Think of this case. We're dealing with an 80-year-old man. We're dealing with a man who's retired for 40 years, has an honorable discharge, has no prior criminal record at all. He's living at home. He's caring for a mentally retarded son. Now, the victim's injuries were not serious, basically hit in the butt as I understood it. And he's convicted of recklessly endangerment. Could just as easily have been a not guilty, but it could have been that the judge was not soft on crime, but hard on crime there.
Judge Messiah Jackson declined to talk about her record on tape. Prosecutors who fought her nomination also declined to comment on specific cases. But they and GOP senators have said they have no regrets. In the prosecutor's reports, Messiah Jackson was painted as a judge who only knew how to give probation, light sentences, or not guilty verdicts. It was those reports that swayed GOP senators. But a committee of the Philadelphia Bar Association, which Gaffney sat on, dug through City Hall records to find transcripts and files of decade-old cases. Their report portrays a record of a careful jurist who regularly imposed tough sentences, and when she didn't, the transcripts show a reasoned decision for acquittal. For example, Commonwealth versus Brockington. The defendant is accused of second-degree robbery, using force when stealing a pair of earrings from a 16-year-old girl. The defendant said it was a case of mistaken identity. He was acquitted by Messiah Jackson. The case was used by prosecutors to bolster the soft-on-crime charge. In fact, the DA's report, sent to senators on the Judiciary Committee, didn't mention that the victim repeatedly failed to identify the defendant. Professor Gaffney.
And when they looked at the photo array, in that same identification, she identified two as being at the crime scene. But even the Commonwealth admitted that the two people she identified were not at that crime scene. The victim failed to identify the defendant in a police lineup. Now, if this doesn't raise a reasonable doubt as to identification, I don't know what does.
But prosecutors fed their interpretation of these cases and others to conservative senators who in turn denounced Messiah Jackson on the Senate floor as another example of a flawed Clinton nominee. She became a potent symbol of the president's attempt, they charged, to pack the courts with liberal activist judges. In fact, several studies of President Clinton's nominees show they're quite centrist. All, including Messiah Jackson, have positive ratings from the American Bar Association. Attorney John Summers is the former head of the Philadelphia Bar's Legal Ethics Committee. He says there's an unsettling lesson out of the Messiah Jackson case, intimidation of judges.
The chilling effect that it can have on all the members of the judiciary, because if it appears that a party has the authority to create reports that don't have the fidelity to the truth that one would have expected, that if one is always worried that that may happen to you, you will be concerned and chilled.
Professor Gaffney agrees. He served for nearly two decades on the Court of Common Pleas. He and other legal minds who actively supported Messiah Jackson for the federal bench warned that her case may signal a more public, heightened politicization of the judiciary, one that he fears is threatening the independence and integrity of the courts.
Who do we want on the courts? We want people who have had these issues, who have had to make these decisions, who have had to make the tough decisions, not the easy decisions, and who have had the courage to make decisions which are going to maybe upset people. If we don't have that type of judiciary, we might as well close up the court system and put in computers.
Legal scholars note that the Founding Fathers gave judicial confirmation powers to the Senate as a check against gross incompetence, corruption, and cronyism, not as a check against alleged ideology. Today, nearly 1 in 8 federal judgeships remain unfilled. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Philadelphia.
In Utah, political activism by students is taking a strange and sometimes violent form. They call themselves the Straight Edge Movement. Their followers shun drugs, alcohol, tobacco, and sexual promiscuity. But some Straight Edge members in Utah have joined the extreme wing of the animal rights movement, and they've been making headlines with acts of sabotage and destruction. NPR's John Biewen reports.
To the untrained eye, straight edgers look like some other young white people who shun the mainstream. They tend to shave their heads, pierce their lips or noses, and wear tattoos and ball-bearing chains. But Jason Dunstan, a 23-year-old bricklayer who lives outside Salt Lake City and a veteran straight edger, says there are tip-offs that he's not, say, just another punk rocker. His T-shirt bears the name of a straight edge band, Snapcase.
We dress for intimidation. So they'll see us and they'll be able to pick us out of a crowd and know not to bring it near us, drugs or alcohol.
Dunstan alludes to the tendency among more militant straight edgers to assault people who approach them with mind-altering substances. But Dunstan says for him, straight edge is a peaceful, healthy movement. He joined almost 10 years ago when he met some straight edgers who were visiting Utah from Seattle. He says he embraced straight edge as a way to loudly declare independence from drugs and alcohol.
My father, when I was really young, was very much into drugs. He used to beat me and my mom and my brother. He killed the family pets so that he could grow pot in their cage.
Dunstan says when he was small, his father shot at him in a stoned rage.
I was grazed in the leg. I was 2 or 3 at the time.
Now Jason uses 4-letter words to describe his father, and he says society does untold damage by glorifying drugs and booze. That's the message of Straight Edge, and says Dunstan, the message is in the music.
The music is what Straight Edge came out of. It was a way for kids to band together against oppression. It let them express their rage for things in a nonviolent way.
Straight edge music is usually metallic and guttural. It emerged from the hardcore punk scenes on the coast in the mid-1980s. But in the 90s, the most prominent straight edge bands don't just scream their disdain for drugs, they also preach militant veganism. Vegans reject the use of all animal products for food or clothing. Earth Crisis of Syracuse, New York is a leading straight edge vegan band. For the fetus, for the cat, for the cow, for the rat, for innocent victims, we will attack, says the song. Nowhere have straight edgers taken that message more to heart than in Salt Lake City.
They used a pipe bomb, which was, you know, a pipe with black powder in it, the 5-minute fuses.
Chris Falco is general manager of the Fur Breeders Agricultural Co-op in suburban Salt Lake City. The co-op makes feed for Utah's large mink farming industry. A year ago, several people broke in at 2 a.m. and set about 5 pipe bombs. They blew up parts of the office and research lab and several trucks outside the building.
Shot shrapnel clear across the street over here. If a car happened to be driving by at that time, they could have easily got hit by the shrapnel.
No one was hurt, but the explosions did $750,000 in damage. In January, 19-year-old Joshua Ellerman, a local straight-edge vegan, confessed to taking part. He faces a minimum mandatory sentence of 30 years in prison for using a pipe bomb. Ellerman is one of 10 Utah straight-edgers who've been convicted in the last couple of years. Others burned a McDonald's, firebombed a leather store, set fire to an animal trap business, and released minks from farms. Federal authorities have identified Salt Lake City as one of 2 or 3 hotbeds of such attacks in the country.
As far as mink releases and firebombings and stuff, within the last 2.5 years, we've had about 45 to 50.
Brent Larson is an officer with the Salt Lake City Police Department's gang unit. He works full-time investigating violence and terrorism by animal rights extremists. A shadowy group called the Animal Liberation Front claims responsibility for the attacks, but Larson says in Salt Lake City, the ALF and Straight Edge are one and the same. He considers Straight Edge the city's fastest-growing criminal gang, with about 1,000 members and 100 or so violent ones.
There seem to be upper to middle class. They come from pretty good families. I think they want to belong to something, and this group kind of takes them in. And when you say no alcohol, no drugs, no tobacco, no promiscuous sex, it sounds real good to these kids for the most part. Yeah, and the parents, I mean, a lot of parents just are in denial. They just don't believe that this is a bad group. You know, as a parent, you think, I'd sign my kid up for this.
Straight Edgers say the police are wrong to tag them with animal rights terrorism. Jason Dunstan says there's no inherent connection between Straight Edge and animal rights. Straight Edge vegans agree that shunning drugs and saving animals are separate causes, but one 17-year-old says for him, one led naturally to the other.
I liberated myself, and now it's just time to move on and help other innocent beings that aren't that fortunate to help themselves, you know.
The young man and his brother, also a Straight Edge vegan, talk on the condition I not use their names. The 22-year-old brother says although he hasn't blown up any animal-related businesses, he supports those who do.
Sometimes it's what's necessary, and if the law enforcement doesn't like it, and if the people in the United States don't like it, well, you know, that's just too bad, because what if one of their rights were taken away? Just like this animal's right to live. What if that right was just taken away? Of course people are going to fight for it, and if people just understood, and people just don't want to understand that. They just refuse to understand it.
Self-described old-school Straight Edgers say vegan vandalism is destroying their movement, giving it a bad name, at least in Utah. A 20-year-old woman who asked that her name not be used says she recently renounced Straight Edge after 7 years in the scene.
When people hear Straight Edge, they don't think of a positive thing like they used to. They don't think of kids who are taking care of themselves, kids who are looking out for others. They think of people who are in a gang. They think of people who are doing violent acts. They think of all these kids that are blowing up buildings. They think of, I mean, completely negative things. And, I mean, I feel like I've made more accomplishments in my life. I'd like to be known for more in my life than just being a Straight Edge punk.
Police say Straight Edge is still growing in Utah, though more slowly now in the wake of bad press about the violence of a few Straight Edgers. John Bewin, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Spring has definitely arrived here in Washington, D.C. There's nothing subtle about it. 80-something degrees, the famed cherry blossoms are exploding. The last thing you want to do is spend your time indoors at an arts museum. But when we heard that the National Gallery of Art has mounted a huge retrospective to honor the late Alexander Calder, we couldn't resist, because Calder's work is like spring itself, exuberant, playful, joyful. By the time Calder died in 1976, he was a legend, one of the most popular and innovative artists in this century. He virtually invented wire sculptures, the art of taking a single strand of metal and then bending it, crimping it to produce fantastic human and animal shapes, like pen and ink drawings leaping into three dimensions. He was one of the first artists to design monumental works for public outdoor spaces, soaring black and red sculptures that inject life into otherwise drab city plazas. But Calder is best known for his mobiles. And as we strolled the other day through the National Gallery with Calder's grandson, Alexander Rower, we are surrounded by Calder's mobiles, like graceful hanging toys, snippets of bright-colored metal, seemingly weightless and defying gravity, playing their tunes as the air currents nudge the pieces together. When he was just a kid, Rower says, he used to watch his grandfather making these mobiles in the jumble of his barn-like studio in Roxbury, Connecticut.
Everybody thought it was totally disorganized chaos, but in fact, he knew where everything was, and he kept all kinds of bits and pieces of things, which he would later use in sculptures, you know, nice little shapes that he had cut off of another thing, but maybe it had been a cutout from a bigger sculpture, but he liked the shape, so he kept it, and maybe 10 years later, he'd use it for something.
And in a booklet that you wrote for this exhibition, there's an amazing black and white photograph of his desk.
Yes.
In the studio, I mean, it is literally 5 feet deep in chaos.
Yes. Yes, and I'm very lucky about that desk because he kept all of his papers. And if you wrote him a letter, he would write a response, and he put a check at the top of your letter with a date, and he put it on the floor. So there are all of these chronological piles around his desk where, when we went to archive all of his papers and classify them, we were able to date things that had been undated because they're all in order, and just thousands and thousands of documents.
Ah, okay, so that's your adult life as his curator. Let's go back to when you were 12. Can you remember one specific incident when you went in and he was working on something and you picked up some tools and started playing around? Or?
There's so many. I would make things in the studio. He'd show me how to use a tool more efficiently. He was very interested in how you constructed things and did it efficiently and with great integrity. I mean, I remember one time when he made me a little object. I didn't know what it was going to be. He took out a roll of wire and a pair of pliers. He sat me down. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And he started making this thing. I couldn't tell what it was. And he started with the wheels. It turned out to be a cart and then a donkey out of wire. And I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was just incredible. I put it on my shelf and admired it. I never played with it. It was never really intended to be a toy. It was just a great thing.
Some of the other artists you've heard of made their best work when they were most anguished, most miserable. Think about Picasso, Van Gogh, Jackson Pollock. It's almost as if the act of creating beauty tormented them. But when you look at Alexander Calder's mobiles, you know this guy was having a great time. There's a photo of him on the museum wall late in life, a big, burly man with chubby cheeks and a mop of white curls and wild eyebrows that give him an impish expression. And who else could give his works names like Candy, the Flying Trapeze, the Lace on the Edge of Your Panties? Calder's grandson, Alexander Roer, shows us one mobile that looks sort of like an orange seal with abstract fish swirling around it. And appropriately,
it's called Little Tinkle. And it's called Little Tinkle because those two red cylinders are actually striking hammers which hit the brass elements, so it makes a sound.
One of the few things I knew about your grandfather, learning about art many years ago, was that he became famous for making these mobiles. But what I did not know was that he and a friend of his actually created the whole term mobile, right?
Sort of. The term mobile was applied to my grandfather's work by Marcel Duchamp in 1931.
Another great artist.
Yeah. And he came to visit my grandfather and saw these latest constructions, which were actually motorized objects. And Duchamp thought these things were really terrific. And my grandfather said, "What shall I call these things?" And Duchamp immediately said, "Mobile," which in French refers both to motion, but also is motive. So it was a pun. And my grandfather loved wordplay, as you can tell from some of the titles of these works, and immediately seized that term for all these motorized works originally, but then it became mobile, anything really kinetic made by my grandfather.
So how do we view your grandfather's works, like these mobiles? When we're looking at this Little Tinkle, for instance, I mean, it's not exactly a sculpture, right? It's not a toy. It's clearly not a painting.
Isn't that confusing? And that was one of the things. He called his work objects.
What was his intent? What did he want us to learn, experience? How did he want us to react?
He wanted you to look at this object and enjoy it.
That's it?
That's it.
What fun.
That's what it was about. He didn't want you to have to interpret one of the shapes or some aspect of it. My grandfather was interested in the interrelationships of things, of objects, and having the move for this constantly changing interrelationship, where these mobiles are constantly reinventing themselves. I mean, you watch one of these things and it's moving. And you turn away for a second, you look back, and it's almost something else.
In fact, this one over here looks like, cherry blossoms hanging from the twigs of a tree, and they're moving every moment, just in the little invisible breeze in this room.
It could be cherry blossoms. It could be a snowstorm. It could be moons around a great sun. It could be so many things. But all it is a bunch of white discs. It's up to you. It's up to you to decide what you think it is. But do you enjoy it? Do you enjoy its grace, its poetry? To me, it has just tremendous power and significance.
Alexander Rower, Alexander Calder's grandson, and director of the Calder Foundation, showing us around the retrospective exhibition at the National Gallery of Art here in Washington, D.C. The show will leave Washington in midsummer and move across the country to San Francisco.